welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 28th of November, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. The year is just flying past. We're almost at the end of November now, almost into the Christmas month at the end of the week. But of course, it's the beginning of the week right now. And you know what that means? That means we are here today to discuss the news that is going to be of interest to British nationalists. And who better to discuss that with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. And a good day to you too as well. I've been out enjoying the unseasonably mild weather that we've been having this time of year, which is really good. The only downside of all of that, though, is that that mild weather has enabled now this year something like 42,000 illegal immigrants to cross the channel and and get into our country illegally. And that's a terrible problem for us.
Yeah, it's been good that we've had this mild weather. We've had good news from America as well, with Nick Fuentes meeting Kanye West and Donald Trump. But then looking over in Britain, it's not such good news in it, especially not when we're thinking about the problem that we have with immigration. Of course, it's not so great to see the increase in numbers that we have in Britain, particularly people that are not actually of the same ethnicity as the indigenous Europeans. And this is because the number of migrants arriving in the United Kingdom has hit the highest number ever recorded. According to latest official figures, the Office for National Statistics confirmed that 504,000 more people came to the UK than left in the year up to June this year. So that's 500,000 people. That figure beats the previous highest record of 390,000 in 2015. And the figures from the Office of National Statistics reveal that more than 1 million people arrived in the UK last year. That's just the ones that we're being told about, more than 1 million people. Nigel Farage has said these net migration figures are hard to take in. 500,000 is nearly the double the previous record. The Tories deserve to be wiped out. And Brexit Watch chairman Ben Habib added, "So much for taking back control of our borders. Suella Braverman urgently needs to get a grip." I mean, that is shocking. That's the highest immigration that we have ever had. And the Tory party were voted in on a platform of limiting migration. The main concern that people had when they voted for Brexit was immigration. And the government have just completely ignored all of that. And we see Keir Starmer shamelessly trying to cash in on this by saying that we need to wean Britain off using immigration for employment, which is absolutely shameless that the Labour Party are now trying to capture the anti-immigration vote, because they're just going to do exactly the same as the Conservative Party and completely ignore what everybody is saying. And of course, you know, I think I do have to say the same thing that I said a couple of weeks back. But the problem is, I think, if they say we're going to limit migration, we're going to stop all of this open borders nonsense, we're going to limit the migration, the legal migration, I think the markets would then do whatever it is that they do, and then the mortgage rates would go up, the pensions would go down, and the general public would not want that government to stay in power. They wouldn't want that party to stay in power. So I think that does play into this, because we did see, I think it was something to do with business, the organisation that represents all the businesses in Britain last week, they also said, well, we need more migration. We need more migration for the economy. We've got lots of jobs that need filling, and we just haven't got the British people to do that. I think some of that is the NHS. And of course, the government have said, well, we do want to have more British people educated. But of course, they're not educated enough. We don't have enough people that are going to be coming out of the universities with medical degrees to actually fill the places in the NHS. And of course, why do we need more places in the NHS? Because we've got more people in the country. So it goes round and round in circles. Why do we need more people? Or rather, we need more people. We need more people in the country to fill these spaces. Well, why do we need more people to fill the spaces? Well, because we've got more people in the country. And it just keeps going on and on, like a snowball that is gathering up more and more snow as it continues. So this is like really in the news at the moment. 500,000 more people came into the country than left. And as I say, we don't actually know that that is the correct number. We also have students to think about. We also have the number of visas that have been handed out, because I think they base this on the number of visas. But of course, they're family visas. It can be far more that it can actually be far more people than that. And I think a lot of the time they're distracting people from this by concentrating on the illegal immigration, which I think is about 40,000 people. So what you've actually got here is 10 times that, 10 times that in legal migration. And of course, this is net migration as well. They're sort of taking the numbers off from the people that have actually left Britain, or the people that have died. I think, I'm not even sure they're including the people that have died. I think they're just people that have left Britain. They subtract that from the figure to get this net figure. So the gross figure is going to be even worse than that. I mean, it's quite shocking, Max, isn't it? But predictable, I think.
It is. I mean, it's interesting that Labour are now trying to sort of appear to be the party of sane immigration, when in fact the Labour Party back in the early part of this century were the party who were wanting to rub the noses of the right in multiculturalism by allowing the maximum number of immigrants to come to this country. The fact of the matter is that the true extent of immigration into Britain is hidden, and it's deliberately hidden so that people can't establish what the actual truth is. And that's why we have immigrants broken down and variously given different titles. And sometimes they're called overseas students, sometimes they're called migrants, sometimes they're called immigrants, sometimes they're called economic migrants, sometimes they're called illegal migrants, sometimes they're called asylum seekers. So the point is that the number of different categories you've got very often will overlap. And then, of course, you've got the family members of all of these different groups that can come in and can be counted in some figures, but not counted in other figures. And so it becomes very, very difficult to actually establish what's going on. But the Office of National Statistics has stated that 504,000 net migrants entered the UK in the 12 months up to June 2022. And this is a record number. The previous record was 331,000, which is in 2015. So it's almost 200,000 in addition to that previous record figure. But of course, at the same time, the figure for the number of visas for people to come and live and work in the UK has been published as well. And this was published in September 2022. In the year up to 2022. And the number was 1.34 million. And so 1.34 million visas have been issued over the last sort of 12 months or so. And this is double the number of the net number of migrants that we've been that we've been told about. So again, there's two figures here which don't quite tally. Of that number of immigrants, the 504,000, apparently 186,000 of them were Ukrainians, Afghans, and Hong Kongers, and there were 89,000 Ukrainians, which, to be quite honest, I've got a great deal of sympathy with, and I've never been an opponent of white immigration to Britain, because I think that if there are insufficient children being born in the UK, then, you know, we do need to have immigration, but it needs to come from countries where the people are compatible with the indigenous British people, so there isn't a race issue that's then caused as a result of that immigration. But Afghans totaled 21,000, Hong Kongers totaled 76,000. And out of the 1.34 million people applying for visas, 476,389 of those apparently were overseas students, and those overseas students brought with them another 116,000 family members. And in fact, if you just look at the category of Nigerian students, 50,980 Nigerian students brought with them 51,648 family members. Now, when I went to college, and when people of my generation went off to college or university, we didn't take our mothers with us. We didn't take our brothers with us. We didn't take our cousins or our wives, because we were young, single people going off to college or university. So, you know, why is it necessary that we have to have a facility for so many family members to come with these students? And the fact of the matter is, if you read there's a Telegraph article which says that the figures for overseas students are no accident, but a deliberate policy by Boris Johnson's government, which committed in February 2021 to increase the number of international students hosted in the UK to 600,000 by 2030 because of the potential economic and soft power benefits. And so, you know, these record numbers of people coming to the UK are not happening by accident. They appear, according to the Telegraph, to be happening deliberately. And it amazes me that in the same Telegraph article, it quotes Professor Alan Smithers, who's the director of the Centre for Education and Employment Research at Buckingham University, where he says that the increase should be investigated because of the risk visas may be used as a means of entering a country where it might otherwise be difficult. But the fact of the matter is that we don't need a university professor to tell us that. Anybody that's got eyes to see and ears to hear will know that that the immigration system and the system for providing educational places at our universities for foreign students, all these things are being abused. And quite often the courses that are being offered to foreign students are really Mickey Mouse courses that just enable them to come into the UK on a visa to attend a Mickey Mouse course. And then, of course, they bring their family with them, and it increases the level of immigration into this country. And so, you know, this whole situation is a completely corrupt mess. And we have the government talking about needing to get a grip of immigration. Well, they don't need to get a grip of immigration. They need to stop it. You know, if they can't control it, then they should stop it until they are able to control it, not just allow it to continue on year after year after year in an uncontrolled fashion the way they do at the moment.
Yeah, I think that coming in on a student visa, that's the more upmarket way of doing it, isn't it? Rather than coming in a boat or coming in the back of a lorry. I think in a boat it costs you $3,000 or $4,000. So what is it going to cost you for a terms student fees to come in on a student visa? Apparently that 600,000 figure that you were referring to there, Max, that Boris Johnson wanted to have by 2030, we've actually got that already just by 2022. So in 2 years, the universities have somehow managed to get 600,000 students in there. And then when you look at the visas, as you were saying, they get a family visa. So it's not just 600,000 foreign students, it's 600,000 foreign students plus all their families, their mothers, fathers, brothers, cousins, they're all coming in as well. So we end up with a huge number of people that are actually coming into the country, not just this net figure of 500,000. As you're pointing out there, there's this talk about some of it coming from Ukraine. GB News tell us that according to the official analysis, the bulk of the increase was driven by arrivals from non-EU nationals, students, and those fleeing the conflict in Ukraine. So they have to add that Ukraine there. But I think the largest number would have been coming from non-EU nationals. And it also tells us there's been a particularly large increase in student visa applications from Indian and Nigerian students in particular. We've also had a high increase in work visas, 250,000 work visas, which is an 82% rise on the pre-pandemic level. Of course, they bring in the word pandemic there to make us think that was what during the lockdown. Pre-pandemic, that is. So it's an 82% rise on what the figure was before we even had COVID. EU nationals represented only around 11% of the work visas granted. 200,000 visas were granted to Ukrainian nationals. As you were saying there, Max, that's not so much of a problem because it's people of the same general European ethnicity as the indigenous British folk, but Albanians were the top nationality, arriving by small boat, and of course that's basically illegal immigration, but then it gets classified as legal immigration once they get given this asylum claim, which I just do not understand. Albanians accounted for 13,650 asylum applications in the year ending September 2022. And when you think there have been, I think, roughly 40,000 people coming in the small boats, so you can say that's almost half of the people coming in the small boats are actually Albanians. 72,000 applications for asylum were made in the last year, close to the previous record peak in 2002. So we're going back 20 years now, and you just cannot beat the numbers that are coming in. And a staggering 77% of the initial asylum applications were granted. And according to the Home Office, that's the highest rate in more than 30 years. I think that's actually the highest rate in Europe. That's more people are being given asylum. More percentage of the asylum applications are being granted in Britain than even in France. Apparently, the figures reveal that only 10% of the Albanian males are granted asylum. So I should imagine that the ones that aren't are just disappearing. And that's who is sort of funding the criminal underworld at the moment. They appear to be the ones that are most involved in the gangland crime. So we have some really staggering statistics here. And we have nobody that is really speaking up about doing anything about this. Nigel Farage is talking of coming back into politics again because of he's just blaming the Conservative Party for this. But it's all of them. And if Nigel Farage comes in again, he's just going to split the vote, isn't he? It just means that less people are going to vote for the Conservatives. And it means that it'll be easier for Labour to get in. Labour, again, as we say, Keir Starmer is now trying to appear to be the anti-immigration party, which is just a joke. I mean, it was because of the Labour Party with Jack Straw as the Home Secretary and Tony Blair as the Prime Minister. You know, they actually went out looking around the world for migrants to bring in because they wanted to, quote, rub the right's nose in it. So it doesn't matter which one of these mainstream parties is in power. They are all going to push for more immigration. And as I say, I think part of this comes from businesses. It comes from the markets that say we need to have immigration to fund the economy. But then, of course, it just puts this huge pressure on services, housing. I think there was an MP that last week that actually spoke up about this and said, why does nobody mention the fact that the reason why we need all these houses is because of immigration? Because we're not producing enough people, Indigenous British people, to replace ourselves. We should have more than enough houses, but we don't. We keep having to build houses. I forget what size of a town in Britain it is every year. It's probably the size of a small city that we now have to build in order to house all these people, just so that the markets can be happy and the businesses can be happy with the number of immigrants that are coming in to cause the economy to keep expanding. It's like a dog that just keeps running around chasing its tail, isn't it, Max?
Yeah, that's the case. I mean, the situation with regard to things like housing, for example, is particularly bad. In the, you know, as you say, every year we're having more housing being built, and the houses are just simply being built to accommodate immigration, because it's immigration is the driver of population increase in this country. And you know, from the point of view of saving our environment, reducing immigration into Britain would be a great thing, because it would mean that we wouldn't need to build so many roads, we wouldn't need to build so many houses, we wouldn't need to have so much infrastructure, and so therefore we would consume less energy as a nation, and that would help towards that. People very often quote the National Health Service whenever immigration comes into question. They say, "Oh, if it wasn't for foreign doctors and nurses, then the whole health service would collapse." Well, if all the foreign doctors and nurses that are in the country at the moment all picked their bags up and went off back to their country of origin, yes, the National Health Service would go through a very difficult struggle, but that's hardly likely to happen. But the fact of the matter is that roughly 10 years ago, I obtained figures relating to the number of people who apply for medical degrees here in the UK, and the each year something like 13,000 people apply for medical attend medical degree courses at universities here in the UK each year, but only 6,000 are accepted, even though the whole 13,000, based upon their academic ability, would be suitable to be accepted, because the government only wants to finance the training of 6,000 doctors a year. And so instead of training the entire 13,000, we only train 6,000, and we then go looking around the world for the other 7,000 to bring into the country to make the National Health Service deliberately multiracial and multicultural. And so the multiculturalization and multiracialization of the National Health Service has been a deliberate policy of successive governments, and one which could be rectified within a very short space of time if all of the people who want to train to be for a medical degree were accepted and taken into universities in the way that they should be. Also, up until a few years ago, most major hospitals or teaching hospitals around the UK, they used to have large halls of residence in their grounds, and these halls of residence were to provide places for student nurses to live. And from all over the UK, student nurses used to come to the training hospitals, and they used to form the backbone. The vast majority, upwards of 95% of nurse applicants in those in the years gone by, would have been nurses from here in the UK. And they were trained, and so there was no need to import nurses from third world countries. But what's happened is that hospitals have been starved of resources, so they have to look around for further premises that won't cost them anything. And so these halls of residence have now been converted into wards, or have now been converted into something else, or in some cases the halls of residence has been demolished and the land has been sold off for redevelopment, so that the health service trust concerned has got more money to pay for MRI scanners or something of that sort, and so the capacity for us to train our own nurses has been taken away. But the capacity to train our own nurses could be brought back again, and it's just simply a matter of the government deciding that it would be better if the National Health Service wasn't dependent upon people from the third world, and it would be better if the majority of doctors spoke English as their first language, and it would be better if the majority of nurses spoke English as their first language and were people from the indigenous population rather than people from far-flung parts of the world. It's just simply a matter of a political decision, and the political decision has been made by successive Labour and Conservative governments to multiculturalise our country deliberately, and to reduce and to create the conditions in which the population growth, natural population growth from within the British people is being prevented by population pressure from immigrants coming into Britain from other parts of the world. And that population pressure shouldn't be there. We should be able to provide for our own people first from our own resources, and as I say, not being dependent upon importing doctors and nurses, etc., from other parts of the world.
I think the vast majority of doctors that end up being struck off for gross misconduct are also non-white. I can remember doing podcasts on this in the past, perhaps even actually on this very show on Real Britannia. I think it was like 80% or 90%, and then there were complaints that perhaps there was a case of discrimination here. But it was basically because these doctors, a lot of the time, these doctors were unable to speak proper English. I mean, that is a huge difficulty. Even if you get somebody who speaks English fairly well, they may not have the vocabulary, enough of a vocabulary to understand what you're talking about, and you may not want to bring up issues because it's taken so much time just to go over one main issue. I mean, perhaps that might be it. That might be one of their ways of getting the waiting list down, is to put in doctors that don't speak English well enough, so that you only talk to them about one complaint, one major complaint, rather than talking about others. And we've also had you were referring there, Max, to these halls of residence, but we've also had nurses that have been turfed out of where they're staying so that illegal immigrants can be put in there. That just happened over the last week. And on top of these figures that we have here, we also have the census, which has just come out. And the census has revealed that 1 in 6 people living in England and Wales were born outside of the UK. 1 in 6. I mean, that is a huge figure. That's 10-15%. And that's all people that have came in the last 10 years. People that are literally born outside of the country. That's not second generation immigrants that have been born to people that came here in an earlier wave of immigration. That's just completely new people that are living in the country. I think if you look at the figures of the children and the ones that are in schools, I mean, that gets even worse. It's something like 30% of the country, 40% of the country are now foreign. When you look at the numbers of the school children that are in the schools, give it another 10 years, 20 years, and that's going to be the majority. I think they talk about 2060 is the time when the Indigenous British set to become a minority in their country. And I did hear that the government and various civil servants and organisations have said that they're no longer going to refer to black and minority ethnics as BAME. They're now going to start referring to them as the global majority, which I think is actually quite useful to us because it shows that we are a global minority. And I can recall a while back seeing memes going around saying that white people only make up 8% of the global population. White women only make up 4% of the global population. We are a minority that we should be working to preserve. So if the government are going to start calling black and minority ethnic the global majority, maybe that's helpful because we can point out, well, we're a global minority, and yet in our countries we are rapidly being displaced by the global majority. You know, if you want to preserve minorities, you want to preserve the diversity of the world, then we need to keep these groups apart, basically. Otherwise, they're going to end up interbreeding, and we're going to end up losing all this wonderful diversity that we have. So we've had some really awful figures coming in, basically, that are covering up the letting us know the rate of this displacement. We're still waiting on the census figures for those that are of foreign ethnicity. So at the moment, we've been told about people that have been born outside of the UK, but we haven't been told about those of foreign ethnicity that immigrated to the UK and have had children here or that were born here. So we don't know what that figure is going to be. I mean, it could be as close to 20%. I say, and if you're going to start including the younger generations, it goes up to 30%, 40%, I think, under the age of 10, something like that. I mean, it really is scandalous, this immigration problem that we have at the moment. Suella Braverman is saying that she's going to do something about it, but I'm starting to really think that that's not the case. We had Liz Truss that was saying that she wanted to increase immigration for the economical reasons. And then we had Suella Braverman that fell out with her over that. And then Suella Braverman was hired again by Rishi Sunak. And she just seems to be concentrating on the illegal immigration and supportive of this huge number of legal migrants. But when you actually look at what the Home Office is doing with this illegal migration, I mean, that's scandalous in itself. Home Office staff were accused of rank incompetence yesterday, after the revelation that each caseworker resolves only one asylum application a week. One asylum application a week. And the accusation came as Suella Braverman revealed that they will receive a bonus of up to £2,500 in a bid to speed up the process. The aim is to quadruple the rate at which claims are resolved, the Home Secretary told MPs. But how is she going to increase the rate that these asylum claims are solved just by giving them £2,500? And it turns out that this £2,500 will be if they stay in the job for 2 years. If they stay in the job for for a year, they get paid £1,500. How is that going to increase the number of asylum claims, which is taking a week? This is why we have this huge backlog. The backlog of cases awaiting an initial decision now stands at 122,000. So 122,000 people waiting to find out on their asylum claim. 40,000 of them are in hotels. So that means another 82,000 of them are in social housing or are staying in private housing, again, that is being paid for by the government. And when they're in this private housing, they get all their bills paid as well. People say, well, they only get £30 or £40 a week, but that's all just to spend on food. They don't have to pay their bills. The bills are all paid. The rent is all paid while they wait to find out what their asylum claim is going to be. And then you've got the government that are talking about Rwanda. We had Steve Laws on here a couple of weeks back, and he said that this Rwanda plan that they had is only to accept something like 200 failed asylum seekers a year. And look at how much that's cost. It's cost the taxpayer £140 million. And And the Home Office are saying it's going to provide value for money. £140 million to send 200 failed asylum seekers to Rwanda. It's absolutely ridiculous. And of course, just in last week as well, they cleared out the Manston Processing Centre, which they were very proud of course. We've got nobody staying there in the Manston Processing Centre. We've managed to process all the fake asylum seekers. And what that means is they've put them all up in hotels. Another 3,000 of them have been put in hotels. We have 40,000 fake asylum seekers. I say they are fake because they're coming in from France. They're not coming here directly from Afghanistan. They're coming here from France. And they are all now being put up in hotels. The immigration problem is just so out of hand, Max. What do you think could be done to fix it?
Well, I think that what's tended to happen in the past is that where small political parties are formed that have an anti-immigration program that want to halt the scandalous situation that's continuing, what happens is that the major parties and the media point to the fact these political parties are small, and they say, oh, they're so small they couldn't possibly win, and they say, oh, that they're so small that they're just made up of people who don't have years of experience of working in a parliamentary democracy like the two main parties, and so therefore the public shouldn't vote for them for those reasons. But the fact of the matter is, this year has shown us that political parties like the Conservative Party and political parties like the Labour Party are an absolute shower, that they are riddled with corruption and incompetence, and so therefore that excuse doesn't exist any longer. And so in future elections, if you go into the polling booth and you're faced with a choice between voting for one of the main political parties who you know is going to allow this immigration scandal to continue, and who you know is a representative of a party that's riddled with scandal and riddled with incompetence, then you then compare them with the person who's perhaps on the next line of the ballot paper, who is from one of the smaller political parties, one of the smaller nationalist political parties, who wants to stop mass immigration into this country, and who is being smeared by the media for their lack of experience of managing a large political organisations or whatever, then you know that you should put your cross next to the person who represents the small nationalist party rather than the person who's representing the establishment party, because at least you know that that person wants to put British people first in this country and wants to stop this mass immigration scandal. The thing you know, if you vote for one of the main political parties, no matter what the person says, because they always say that they want to control or get a grip of immigration, but they never actually do, and they never actually reduce immigration. All they do is facilitate greater immigration as time goes by. So you know that if you vote for the person from the main political party, that the immigration scandal is going to continue and get worse. So make sure that you vote for the Nationalist Party, no matter how small or insignificant they may be, no matter how lacking in experience of operating in a parliamentary democracy they may appear. Vote for them because at least you know that they, when they get into office, will do everything they can to stop the immigration scandal.
You know, there was a time when we did actually have governments that did actually used to think about the people they were governing, and they did actually used to try and do their best for them, or at least we did actually have politicians who were doing that, and particularly back in the early 1900s, I think. Shall we move into discussing our eugenics presentation, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, and we're going to begin with the Sterilisation Bill of 1931, which is, like, obviously at this time, the British government was more concerned with the British citizens and trying to do its best for them rather than doing what's best globally. The Sterilisation Bill of 1931 was introduced by Major A.G. Church, Labour MP for Wandsworth and Organising Secretary of the Eugenics Society. Again, which shows that eugenics wasn't right-wing, it wasn't left-wing, it was just a sensible thing to be doing, basically. So you have a Labour MP here that's introducing this. It aimed to legalise the voluntary sterilisation of mental defectives. And of course, the important part there is voluntary. This was not forced. And I dare say, if you had people that were really mentally defective, it would have to be their carers that were actually giving their consent. The bill was reproduced in a pamphlet entitled Better Unborn, which showed the consequences of encouraging fertility of dysgenic stocks. Open brackets, people with supposedly undesirable genetic characteristics, close brackets, with a view to garnering parliamentary and wider support. It was rejected by 167 votes to 89, the main opponents once again being Roman Catholics and Labour MPs, although most abstained. Among those who did vote for the bill were Eleanor Rathbone and Ellen Wilkinson. I think this, they're really sort of concentrating here on what we've talked about before, about how the purpose of doing this wasn't to harm people that were here, it wasn't to restrict their rights, it was to make sure that the next generation were born into healthy bodies with healthy minds. They didn't want to have people that were born into a body that would have to be looked after for the rest of their life because they were unfit, unable to take care of themselves, unable to really experience the fullness of what it means to be a human being. And I think that is implied with the title of the pamphlet here, Better Unborn. And I think also the important point to make here is that it was voluntary sterilization. It wasn't forcing this on people. It wasn't going out to all the people with a low IQ and holding them down and anaesthetizing them and giving them the snip. It wasn't anything like that. It was a suggestion for voluntary sterilization. And as I say, I think it would have been the carers that actually gave the consent for that. What do you make of the sterilization bill of 1931, Max?
I think it would have been something which would have been well intended. I think though that it would have probably involved the sterilization of people who probably would never have reproduced in any event. And I think that if they were reproducing, it would have been because they were in sanatoriums or hospitals of some sort where they weren't being properly supervised, and people who lacked mental capacity were going off together as couples and having sex and then producing children. So I think as far as people in that category are concerned, then it would have been quite a sensible thing to do, because it would have then prevented further people with similar disabilities and incapacities being born. I don't think though that that it would have actually had a wider effect than that, because people who lack mental capacity when they are at large in society probably would very rarely find anybody that would be willing to pair up with them as husband and wife or whatever, or to have children by them. So but it would improve the situation in institutions where people who lacked mental capacity were perhaps sent and prevent them from, as I say, illicitly having children together when they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I think it was probably more aimed at the inmates in the asylums. And it's interesting, the way that this was portrayed was that it was a right, actually, of the mentally defective, which sort of implies that they were engaging in sexual relations and they had a right to not have to force their mentally defective genes upon another generation. And this is because a parliamentary report known as the Brock Report of the Departmental Committee on Sterilisation of 1933 was unanimous in its conclusion that allowing and even encouraging mentally defective and mentally disordered patients to be sterilised was justified. So the parliamentary report actually advocated for this. Only 3 out of the 60 witnesses who gave evidence, comprising of psychiatrists, biologists, medical professionals, local authority representatives and social workers, were opposed to its recommendations on principle. So this wasn't about principle. This was basically about cause and effect and common sense. I mean, it's only logical, really, that you don't want people that are mentally defective to be creating lots of other people that are mentally defective. And the committee itself considers sterilization to be a right of the mentally defective and advocated extending it to those with physical disabilities as well. I mean, I'm quite surprised that this didn't actually manage to get through, considering it seems that most people were actually for this and they weren't actually considering rejecting it on principle, which is what the Roman Catholics were doing. I mean, they say that all life has a right to live, even if it is mentally defective and physically defective. And as I pointed out before, their reasoning for that is because they say that man is created in the image of God. Man is sacred, therefore all life is sacred. But if the life is going to be born mentally defective and physically defective, is that not a mockery of the image of God? And shouldn't it be an onus upon us to prevent that from happening? Shouldn't we be doing all we can to prevent that from happening? Which I think was the mentality that this parliamentary report had. Because they saw this as a right of the mentally defective to be able to have sex without then forcing that mental defectiveness onto the next generation. I think that was the way that they put this. What do you make of this, Max?
Well, I think I pretty much agree with you there that it's a matter, well, as I said earlier on, it's just really a matter of preventing people who lack mental capacity from reproducing in institutions, in my view, and I think that that's the perfectly healthy thing to do. I think if you have somebody who is so mentally affected that they can't lead a normal life, and so that they are effectively like small children or babies, even. So you get some people who are so mentally damaged that they effectively, although they grow into a human-sized person eventually, that they never acquire the mental capacity of even a one-year-old child in some cases, and so therefore they are completely helpless. And somebody who's in an institution in that sort of condition would be completely helpless, and but they would have adult genitalia and adult bodies, and other people in the same institution could then take advantage of them, and there's no way that they could resist. And so, you know, it's in the interest of that person to be protected against unwanted pregnancies, or, you know, by having advantage taken off them. And you know, in the discussions we've had about eugenics, I've said in the past that we shouldn't try to force people who might want to have families from having we shouldn't prevent them from having families. We should always we should just encourage people who've got undesirable mental or physical characteristics to have children at below replacement level. You know, that I firmly believe, but there is a degree of mental deformity beyond which euthanasia probably would be the most appropriate thing to do. And I don't say this with any sort of easy heart, because it's always difficult to sort of suggest something like this. But the fact of the matter is, you sometimes see middle-aged couples pushing a pram around a town centre with a you know, what was one of their children in there, who is still no more advanced than a newborn baby would be, and where looking after that child has totally dominated the lives of those parents. And they've been lovely people. Despite the great deformity of their child, they've loved the child and they've done what they thought was the best thing by trying to raise that child themselves. In looking after a child of that size, who is incapacitated as a newborn baby, it's dominated their lives to the extent that it's in many cases prevented them from having holidays. It's prevented them from following the sort of careers that they would like to follow had they been able to. And in some cases, the child that is the problem is not their first child. It's perhaps their second child. And where it's their second child, the effort that parents have to invest in looking after the damaged child totally detracts from the quality of life that the healthy child that they had first of all should have expected to have. And so what happens is that the perpetuating the life of the damaged child effectively then severely limits and in some cases ruins the life of their parents and their siblings. And so, you know, in that situation, there is a very strong argument for euthanasia, and parents should be able to feel that they can make that decision without being judged, in my view. In the situation that we're talking about here, where we're dealing with people that's, in my view, would primarily be people who would be in institutions, applying a policy of sterilization, then that would be a less severe eugenic remedy. And one which should have been seen by everybody as being the most sensible thing to do.
Yeah, I think perhaps in some instances it might even be better that if that was a decision that was to be taken by the state in the instance that you're talking about there, Max. You know, because of the burden that it's going to place upon the people bringing up the child, they're not going to be able to contribute to the community. Obviously, the bringing up of any other children in the family is going to suffer because of it. But at the same time, then you would be saying that, well, if the state shouldn't have the right to do that. It should be up to the parents. But again, on the other hand, the parents might find it difficult to make that decision, and it might be easier if it was made by the state. I guess these are the sort of ethical considerations that have to be discussed when you're talking about these sort of things. And I think one principle that you could say is that if somebody is not able to bring up a child, not able to care for a child themselves, then they should not have the right to have a child. That should not be inflicted upon a child to be brought up by somebody that is unable to bring a child up. If you had somebody in one of these asylums that was mentally disabled to the extent that they would be unable to raise a child, then they shouldn't be able to be put in that position where they have to raise a child, because obviously they're not going to. Somebody else is going to have to do it. And that just means that another generation is born with the same deformities, mental disabilities, or whatever the congenital problem is. Although it did not derail committed eugenicists from their belief in voluntary sterilisation, the rise to power of the National Socialists in 1933 and the passing of compulsory sterilisation legislation in Germany may have helped prevent such views from gaining traction in Britain. So in Germany, they brought in an act of compulsory sterilization for people that had congenital diseases. And in Britain, we were trying to bring in an act with voluntary sterilization. And the notes here put the voluntary in quote marks. And as I say, that's probably because these are the sort of people that wouldn't actually be able to give their own consent because they were that mentally disabled, but their carers would have been able to do that. Attempts in 1934 and 1937 to implement the report of the Brock Committee on Sterilisation came to nothing. And remember, I mean, so that was the advice that was being given. After a parliamentary investigation, the report that was given was saying you should pass a bill for voluntary sterilisation, and the government ignored the advice from their own committee. And widespread institutional sterilisation of people with disabilities was not carried out in Britain. Meanwhile, the scientific credibility of eugenics was itself under increasing scrutiny. And again, I think that was due to World War II that took place shortly after that, and the negative promotion of the negative eugenics that was being carried out in Germany. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, that would have been the result of anti-German feeling would have caused people who were opponents of eugenics in this country to play on that anti-German feeling and say, oh, this is something that the Germans want to do, and so we should not want to do it because we're in opposition to the Germans, and it's as simple as that. The same thing happened in the United States. There was legislation in various states in the United States of America for voluntary sterilization, and I think in some cases compulsory sterilization. As a result of the Second World War, those people who were who were opposed to eugenics used the anti-German feeling that existed at the time in order to say, you know, we shouldn't do this because this is what the Germans do. You know, it's the silly argument that, you know, the Germans put their trousers on one leg at a time, so therefore we should try and jump into both legs of our trousers in one go kind of argument. You know, don't do the sensible thing because it's a thing that the Germans used to do.
Yeah, it's an argument that's still used today, isn't it? All the time against nationalists. And nationalists are something quite sensible, such as, you know, we have an issue with open borders and far too much immigration. And then if a politician says the same, he will get accused of being a white supremacist because it was the white supremacist who said something quite sensible, such as we have an immigration problem. And it was after the Second World War, really, that eugenics fell right out of favour, particularly in Britain. In 1945, the Eugenics Society stressed the gulf that separates eugenics from the Nazi doctrines of race hygiene and racial superiority. And that's an exact quote. So the Eugenics Society saw that what they wanted to do was completely different from the German policies. The aim was now to separate itself from, quote, perversions, unquote, of eugenics, and redirect attention to Sir Francis Galton's standpoint, which was not exactly unproblematic. In the same year, it repeated its commitment to the Brock Committee's recommendation on voluntary sterilisation, and in this, it was starting to get increasingly out of step with mainstream thinking. So the Eugenics Society itself saw that what it was doing was completely different from the race hygiene and the racial superiority that was being talked about in Germany. Yet it was because of this that it sort of got tarred with the same brush, even though in Britain we were talking about voluntary sterilisation, not enforced sterilisation. I mean, there's a big difference there in the positive eugenics that Sir Francis Galton was talking about, and, you know, and state enforced sterilization. And I think euthanasia played into it as well. But also, I think in Germany, you had the financial cost of the war also led to some policies that maybe wouldn't have been put in place if they hadn't actually been in wartime, because the cost that it's going to cost for medical care and to look after the disabled when you're actually on a war footing, I mean, it could be said that that's a luxury that they just could not afford. So that may have sort of led to them having the enforced sterilization, perhaps enforced euthanasia, because they just didn't have the resources to look after these people when they had to put all their resources into defending the country, you know, in the middle of a world war. So I don't think we can. What I'm saying, I think, is basically if Germany hadn't been on a war footing, perhaps they might have had slightly different policies. And instead of it being state enforced, perhaps maybe it would have been voluntary, as it was in Britain. But there was certainly a difference between the British view on this and the German view, I would have thought. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, I think that different people will have slightly different ideas. The principle of eugenics is a sound idea. How radically you want to impose eugenic ideas on the society is a matter for sort of individual choice. But I think that as we've already agreed, a humane program of eugenics wouldn't involve compulsion other than in the most extreme cases, such as I've already described. As far as sterilization is concerned, it would not be something that you would force people to have if you were applying a humane program of eugenics. What tended to happen prior to the Second World War is that some of the people promoting eugenics did go a bit too far and did did impose or try to sort of advance legislation that would have made possible compulsory eugenic measures in situations where it wasn't, in my view, appropriate. And that combined with the anti-German feeling that grew up as a result of the Second World War just created the political climate where eugenics was discredited. But it wasn't discredited from an intellectual point of view. It was discredited from an emotional point of view because of the emotion of anti-German feeling rather than because in any academic sense, the need for eugenics or the benefits of eugenics had been discredited.
Yeah, it's all about benefiting the group rather than benefiting the individual. And that is ethical considerations that should be talked about and discussed. But when it all becomes about feelings, you tend to forget about that. They're just sort of looking at it closely and, you know, how not very nice it would be for somebody not to be able to have children, instead of looking at the bigger picture of what that actually causes the burden on society if those children are going to be born with mental or physical infirmities.
When you consider that the royal family had to change their name from Battenberg to Windsor as a result of the anti-German feeling that grew up during the 20th century, if even the royal family had to change their name so that they couldn't be tarnished by any kind of association with Germany, it shows you the level of emotional the strength of emotions that would have been stirred up by people who were opponents of eugenics. And during the 20th century, particularly the early part of the 20th century, Roman Catholic population here in the UK was far more militant, and in view of the fact that the Roman Catholic religion is against any form of contraception, so therefore the anti-contraception argument and definition also the anti-eugenics arguments would have figured highly and they would have worked very strenuously against them.
Yeah, we really shouldn't underestimate the strength of this anti-German feeling. In the 1950s, the society suggested the implementation of checks on West Indian immigration. It published Colin Bertram's Broadsheet on West Indian Immigration of 1958, the recommendations of which included so-called racist considerations of quotas for West Indians and testing for the quality of attributes of all immigrants. However, the society also reprinted scientific, anthropological, and cultural criticisms of Bertram's research. So the society was trying to portray both sides of the argument here. But why should it be considered racist? I guess because it's saying, well, you're discriminating against one racist of another when you're talking about quotas of West Indians. But then West Indians were a completely different race to the indigenous British. So quite clearly it should be considered that if you're going to import a group of people from a different race or from a different ethnicity, you have to consider the quota. You have to consider the percentage that is going to be there in the country. I mean, you could say, well, you know, 0.5% or 1% non-white wouldn't be a problem in their own area, particularly in a capital city. Capital cities of the world have all different peoples in them by necessity for business and for that sort of thing. So you would think that it would be quite a sensible idea to say, well, you should have quotas, regardless of it being the Eugenic Society that is saying this. I should imagine they were probably saying it because of the chances of interbreeding, and interbreeding would obviously, that would be a negative on the ethnic integrity of the indigenous Britons, attesting for the quality of attributes. I mean, again, that I don't see how that could be considered racist, because you do test people for a job, don't you? Your job interview, You know, we test people at school, at education. You want people with the best qualifications to go on into university. So what this is suggesting here is that maybe IQ tests of immigrants to see whether they're going to be of benefit to a group of people with an average IQ of 100, for instance. So if you've got immigrants that have got an IQ of 65 or 70, then they're not really going to be of much help to a country with an average IQ of 100, are they? What they're going to end up doing is gradually bringing down the average IQ of the country, which is what we see happening. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Or because of the fact that they were not able to compete with the indigenous people on the basis of IQ, it would mean that they would end up doing less well-paid jobs. They would perhaps be more likely to end up being unemployed, and they would be quite likely to spend their entire lives complaining that they weren't being given the same rights as the indigenous people, which is pretty much what we've seen happen, that representatives of immigrant groups have spent their entire time since the time of the very first boats that were bringing immigrants into this country after the Second World War, all the way through today, they have constantly complained and moaned about the fact that their people aren't achieving the success that is the expected level of success for the indigenous population, and that the thing that they're refusing to focus on is the quality and the qualities and the attributes of the people that compose those immigrant groups.
I think you make a very good point there. I mean, if they had actually tested for the quality of the West Indian immigrants, and by that I mean tested for the IQ, and they showed that they had an IQ of 75 or 80. Then that would have explained the reason why they had different outcomes to a people group with an average IQ of 100. And of course, they didn't do that. So then, of course, they say, well, what is the reason why these West Indian immigrants aren't doing so well as the indigenous British people? Well, it must be racism. Of course, if they'd actually tested for the quality, if they'd done IQ tests, they wouldn't have been able to say that. And of course, it isn't fair on them to be on a group with a lower average IQ to then be competing against a group with a higher average IQ. Quite clearly, that's not fair. But if you tell the groups that they're both equal to one another, then there's going to be resentment from both sides, isn't there? There's going to be resentment on the side that have the lower IQ, because they're being told that there's no difference between them and the group with the higher IQ, and the group with the higher IQ is going to end up resenting it because they're being told that they're the ones that are to blame for this, as if they're discriminating against the group with the lower IQ. So, I mean, I think this was quite a sensible suggestion that the Eugenic Society were making, and because it wasn't implemented, because it was ignored, we've had the growth of all this grievance culture and all this allegations of institutional racism that is responsible for these different outcomes. The eugenics movement in Britain peddled ideas that today seem offensive and downright dangerous, and had some prominent adherents. However, it never gained truly widespread appeal, and environmental and social reforms were increasingly seen as a more effective and humane remedy for social problems. As I say here, it didn't really gain widespread appeal, but it was intellectuals that supported it more so than anybody else, because they understood it. Eugenics was also unsuccessful in its aim of stemming the fall in birth rates among those groups it deemed fitter, as women sought to control their own fertility by the use of contraception across many social groups. And I think the rise of feminism played a big part in that, in encouraging women not to have children and to go on and have careers, particularly the more intelligent women that you would have wanted to have large families. The Eugenics Society itself was renamed the Galton Institute in 1989 after Sir Francis Galton, and since then the organisation has sought to address questions raised by the scientific exploration of human heredity, and to promote education and public engagement, not only with the current science, but also with its origins and history. And in 2020, the UCL announced the redesignation of those parts of their premises that had been named in honour of Galton, Pearson and Fisher. Imagine that. I mean, these guys were responsible for the birth of statistics, great leaps forward in our understanding of heredity. These guys came out with laws of nature. And then you have the University of London, which is renaming places after them because they're so embarrassed about the findings that they actually made. It's not like they've said, well, we've come out with new theories and these new theories have been proved and they disprove the theories of Galton, Pearson and Fisher. They're just saying because their ideas are offensive, we have to get rid of them. We have to cancel them. You know, some of the most intelligent people that we ever had. And this is, you know, this is the reason why eugenics isn't really looked into. And as we've said all along, there's positive eugenics, there's negative eugenics, but the whole idea of it is about improving the lives for the next generation. It's quite a selfless way of doing things. And people might say, well, it's not these intelligent people that are being encouraged not to breed. But as you've pointed out, Max, it would just have to be if they just had one child instead of two. And then through the generations, you would end up with less and less people that had these less desirable characteristics. It's a great shame that these organisations are so embarrassed by the people that actually came up with all these ideas in the first place. I think, Max, what do you make of them renaming the Eugenics Institute and then renaming everything that was named after them?
Well, I think that's it's a terrible thing that's being done. What we have to accept is that moral standards that apply will differ in different ages, and that you shouldn't try and judge people from the past against current day moral standards. The fact of the matter is, though, that even that argument is made insignificant by the argument that that various of these people that have been cancelled and whose where buildings have been renamed so that they're not named after them were people who not only provided great leaps forward for our understanding in terms of science, etc., but are people who applied their own personal fortune to creating the institutions that are now cancelling them and renaming the buildings, etc., that were originally named in their honour. And I think that particularly is iniquitous because, you know, if you don't want to be associated with a person because of what they did during their lifetime, then you should at least have the integrity to donate the money that they gave you to organizations that do support the things that those people wanted during their lifetime. So that organizations like the UCL, they want to have the benefit of the money that was given to them by these great Britons. But they don't want to. But they then want to disassociate themselves from those people, so that nobody thinks that they may have any sympathy with them whatsoever. It's like somebody waiting until their parent has died, and that the parent's estate is then passed on to them in their will, and then publicly denouncing their parent in every possible way as somebody who was to be disparaged. It's just really, really bad form. It's a terrible thing to do. If you don't want to dignify your parent, or you don't want to dignify the person who's provided the money to enable your institution to be created and to function, then you should give the money back and give it to somebody who will honour the parent or who will honour the institution.
I think society needs to be objective and politically neutral or politically blind as well. Otherwise, it's not science, is it? If it's being affected by political correctness, political sensibilities, then it's no longer being objective. It's no longer finding out exactly the way that the world works. because you're not looking at that anymore because you're concerned of how it might hurt somebody's feelings. So we'll just pretend that the world isn't the way that it is because it might hurt somebody else's feelings if we do describe how it actually is. I mean, it's scandalous, really, to have science affected like this. And that is what we're seeing. Political correctness is really hampering science today. If any studies actually turn out with any information that could be considered to hurt the feelings of any minorities, then that study is not going to get published. It's not going to get talked about. It's not going to get funding. And yet there are differences between all the different groups. And the anthropology should be the study of that, should be the study of these differences. And yet anthropology today just completely has its hands tied. And yet all this information is coming out there, particularly through DNA research showing the link between genetics and intelligence. I think it was the guy that actually first came out with DNA. He ended up being cancelled for saying that there were these differences between people groups, and that is what all this boils down to. Basically, it's political correctness, and that putting a stop to the science that we have, and also discrediting the names of these great people that made possible these great leaps forwards, particularly Galton and Pearson, and with the use of statistics. Well, that pretty much finishes with the section on British eugenics. We'll start another section on eugenics in the next episode. Thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.